Hi there, and welcome to another episode of West Obsessed, where the writers and editors of High Country News discuss issues critical to the health of the American West. I'm Brian Calvert. I'm the editor-in-chief of High Country News, and I'm broadcasting today from our partner studio, KVNF, in Paonia, Colorado. Today, we're going to talk about, I think, a really important issue across the American West, and one that can be kind of confusing, but people get really passionate about anyway, which is the damming of rivers. Here to help me do that is our deputy editor digital, Kate Schimmel. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Brian.
And our editorial fellow, Emily Benson. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Brian.
You guys have both done reporting on some rivers and dams in different ways. We're going to talk about all of that in a second. But first, I just wanted to say, or ask you, Kate, why you thought we should look into dams in general at this time, because they're kind of a much reported on issue in the West. Why do you think we did it now?
Well, I think it's kind of an interesting moment in dam politics. There was a moment a few years ago when there was all of this energy about dam removal. There was a movie that came out called Damnation that really advocated for removing many of the West's biggest dams. And there was a lot of passion in a lot of Western communities about doing so, and also against doing so. And in the years since, some dams have actually come down, and many have not. And for me, I thought it was an important time to talk about, with the change in the presidency and the change in the politics of dams, what has happened, what have we learned from it, and what can we do going forward?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that dams are a very, very particular, they're a character in the American West. The American West is often defined by that region of the United States west of the 100th meridian, which is characterized by aridity often. And that's the sort of interior West, the arid West, we call it. Then you have the Pacific Northwest, which is really defined by its rivers and the damming of those rivers and the impact of those dams on the salmon and the people who rely on salmon. And then you get into sort of hydropower questions. And also you get into the sort of really, really hardcore environmentalists who were very upset when the Glen Canyon Dam came up. And this is sort of like Ed Abbey's country. And David Brower, the head of the Sierra Club, always regretted not getting into the fight on the Glen Canyon Dam. The Glen Canyon Dam was built and it created Lake Powell. You have then another dam that creates Lake Mead, which is the Hoover Dam. And these are like big, big, huge environmental issues and fights. In fact, they're kind of necessary for people to live in the West, to even care about the West. They provide ways to store a lot of snowmelt, which is really our water bank in the West, and they create power for a lot of communities that live along them. So it's not just as easy as, okay, we'll just tear them all down because they were a mistake that we made in our country's history. There's a lot to it. So what we did was we kind of set about putting together an issue where we examined a bunch of these questions about dams. Kate, we sent you to Washington, the Olympic Mountains, to look at a river called the Elwha, which 6 years ago had its dam come down. Why that river? And kind of walk us through what you thought was most interesting as you were sort of approaching your reporting.
Well, the Elwha is sort of interesting inside that context you just discussed, because as far as rivers go in the West, it's easy to undam in a way. It only had two. It was a pretty short river, and it wasn't connected to a lot of other rivers. So the Hoover Dam, the Glen Canyon Dam, you're talking about huge water systems with many, many dams, many, many reservoirs connected to feed huge metropolises. The Elwha was pretty straightforward. There was a tribe, the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe, that had rights to the fish and to the water of the Elwha River. And once these dams really powered the city of Port Angeles. But
so these were put up as hydropower dams.
These were put up as hydropower dams, which is characteristic of a lot of Northwest dams. It sort of allowed the industrialization of the Northwest. So many were put up to power mills to deal with all of the logging that was coming in. And that was true of the Elwha dams as well.
So we have to put in these dams so we can cut down all these trees, but then at the expense of all these fish.
Exactly.
So good job, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it was controversial from the start. At the very start, when the dams were built, they even then, 100 years ago, they were supposed to have fish passage, and they didn't. Lawsuits over the Elwha started way back in the 1980s in terms of trying to take those dams down, really spurred by the Lower Elwha Tlalum tribe.
So before you were even born.
Yes, before I was born, because I am a child. You can't tell from my voice, but I am actually 7.
Well, you can tell. Go on. So these debates were raging before you were even born.
Before I was long, long before I was born, way back up in a mythic land called the Pacific Northwest, a group of people came together to fight against the dams. So lawsuits began in the 1980s. And as early as the 1990s, when there was a law passed in Congress to resolve the issue on the Elwha, a group of researchers began referring to the Elwha as a living laboratory. What they wanted to do on the Elwha was see what happens when you completely undam a river. Study it before the dams come down and after, and see what happens and see what it looks like for a river to reassemble itself. And I found that concept fascinating, especially at this moment in time when so many ecosystems seem to be completely reshaping themselves and being disrupted. What does it look like to watch an ecosystem come back together in a way?
And what did happen when the dams came down?
Yeah, a lot of chaos. And mostly good chaos, but chaos is destructive. It was interesting how tolerant researchers were of that chaos.
Just to walk us through how long did it take, like, to take the dams down? Like, what does that even look like? Do you just sort of, is it like a stick of dynamite and a plunger?
No, it's not quite
it's
that.
It's not like in the cartoons?
It's not quite that straightforward. And on the Elwha, the way the dams were taken down was very, very intentional. So basically, over the course of 3 years, the dams were gradually taken down step by step. And the reason for that was that you would get these pulses of water through the river, but you wouldn't have all of the sediment, all of the detritus from 100 years of damming flow down the river immediately. And there were a couple reasons for that. One was you actually, it prevents downstream effects on the humans and on the river system. And you can also really carefully study how much sediment is being pushed down the river. And I think actually that it allowed them to push more sediment down the river, because you would have these like sort of reshape, you know, the lake bed would reshape itself and then it would push sediment down again. And you can bring those, and it gave them a way of seeing, basically studying how fast you can take a dam down and what that does to the river. So they took it down at one speed and they studied the effect of that. And they can now kind of modulate that depending on the dam they're taking down.
And what did the river do? Did it just return to its natural state, like pre-dam state, or did it kind of take on like a whole new sort of life of its own?
Yeah, we're a long way from pre-dam state. A lot has changed on the river that will probably never change back. So you have construction all along the river's lower stretches, and you have climate change, and you have these things that really prevent sort of the restoration of what I think people might refer to as a pristine ecosystem. But what you do have is the return of flexibility. So the river can move around, it can change, it can adapt. Its animals and plants can adapt much more easily than when the dams were in.
So it's kind of like a slow motion wriggly fire hose that
exactly.
kind of like makes its way out of these dams.
Exactly, yeah. So when you have the dams in there.
You should have written that. All right, so what did the scientists learn? Because it was this living lab and, okay, we're going to take these dams down. And what did they learn?
Well, they learned that taking dams down is hard. But they also learned that some things reassemble themselves very quickly. So there, when the dams were in the beachfront where the river came out, so it flows into the ocean, into the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and where it came out was just like huge boulders. There was not really a beach. There was a surf break that only broke every so often. And so now 6 years later, there's an entire beachfront. So there's this huge beach. It's very healthy. A whole estuary that is a haven for young fish, for birds, for crabs, for a whole ecosystem there has kind of pulled itself back together very, very quickly.
I think I speak for all of us when I say, what happened to the surf break?
I thought you might ask about that. So it breaks much more regularly now.
Sweet.
So when I visited, there were like families on the beach wandering around in a place where they couldn't have 6 years ago. And there was also a happy, happy surfer sitting out there waiting for a break.
Sounds like a vacation waiting to happen.
Yeah. Everyone's idea of a great vacation, sitting in the rain waiting for a wave to break.
Yeah. Awesome. If you're just joining us, you're listening to West Obsessed, where the writers and editors of High Country News discuss issues critical to the American West. I'm here with our deputy editor, Digital, Kate Schimmel, and our editorial fellow, Emily Benson. We're talking about dams. We've been talking about a dam that came down. But the truth is, when we talk about dams in the West, it's not all about, like, do we take one down or not, or leave it in place? There are still very active ideas about dams. Most often in the sort of water supply aridity question. I think that's a really big question going into climate change. There are drier times ahead for a lot of parts of the West. There are also more people moving into the West. So there are big questions about how to just get water to people. One of the big places where this is happening is the Wasatch Front and sort of Salt Lake City and that whole metropolis there. Emily, we sent you there to figure out what was happening on a river called the Bear River, where they've had plans to maybe divert that river for a really long time. So just to give us the geography a little bit, what is the Bear River and what is its relationship to the Great Salt Lake?
So the Bear River is the main way that the Great Salt Lake gets fresh water. So the Great Salt Lake, it doesn't drain to the ocean. All the rivers that come into it drain into the basin of the Great Salt Lake. And then the reason why it's so salty is because some of that water evaporates and the salt stays behind. But for the ecology of the lake, it is really important that it gets freshwater inputs. Those kind of feed the marshes and the bugs that feed the birds that live there and that stop by there. It's a major place that's really important for migratory birds in the West.
Yeah, basically, like, the Great Salt Lake is like a big flying J for
birds. Yeah, they stop
migratory
by.
Migratory birds.
Yep, they stop by for rest. They stop by to find something to eat. They stop by to breed. So the freshwater inputs to the lake are really important.
Much like a truck stop.
Yeah, much like a truck stop.
Go on.
So it's really important that there are these freshwater flows that go into the lake. And the Bear River provides about 60% of that freshwater flow. So the Bear River is kind of an interesting one. It's pretty short, but it's also very windy. So it goes through parts of Wyoming and parts of Idaho and parts of Utah. And all three of those states share the river. They divert some of it for irrigation and for drinking water and for power generation.
But it's a wiggly river.
It's a wiggly river. Those three states share it. And so
they share the water that comes out of it. Because I think there's a reservoir that
is
up in Wyoming.
Yep.
And, you know, you really speed by it when you're trying to get out of Wyoming and into Utah.
Yeah.
Tell you that.
Yeah, so a lot of the water in that river, it's not like that's a completely pristine river. That river is already being used in a lot of ways. But Utah does not use all of the water that was allocated to it, all of the water that the state is legally entitled to use from that river. And so what's left over now goes into the Great Salt Lake right now. But Utah in the 90s and earlier started talking about actually diverting some of that water that it's legally entitled to, some more of that water. And so they talked about building some kind of project on the Bear River that would probably be a series of dams that would be used for water storage to get water that could be used by nearby communities.
So this is kind of a classic setup where ecologically speaking, you'd like to see as much water as possible return to the Great Salt Lake because it's there's some interesting characteristics of the Great Salt Lake. It's relatively shallow in a lot of places, so it doesn't take very much. If you lose river water coming into it, you kind of lose a lot of shoreline. It kind of like shrinks up rather quickly.
That's right. And yeah. Yeah, so the water would shrink, but that would leave behind a lot of dry lake bed. And that is kind of one of the problems here, is that when that lake bed dries up, that kind of leaves behind all the sand and the dirt that's there, and that can be stirred up by the wind, and that can be really damaging for people's health that live nearby.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, so you sort of have people's health versus trying to deliver the right amount of water to a growing population.
Mm-hmm.
How are they sort of grappling with this in terms of the planners? Because it's kind of like a moving target.
Yeah, so they've been talking about doing this for a really long time, for decades now. And it's really interesting because you can see the conversation sort of evolve over that time. So from the beginning and even now, Utah's population is growing. It has been growing, and especially along the Wasatch Front right there in that area. But it's still growing, but the rate of that growth is starting to slow now. And also the other thing that's going on is that people are getting a lot better at conserving water. So planners have to kind of look at those numbers and see what's going on now, but they also have to think about, you know, what's going to happen in the future. What's it going to be like in 20 years, in 50 years, in 100 years?
Basically, people have to figure out how smart humans are going to get, which is hard to predict given the current news cycle.
Not something to bet on.
No, it's not. We're going to get better at everything, and conserving water, being nice to each other. Not so much.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen? Are they going to do it?
I don't know. And the people that I talked to lots of people for this story, and none of them know either. It's an open question.
Yeah, there's a really interesting part of your story where a woman's title changed from
project manager to program manager.
Right. So they quit thinking of it as a project.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, we don't even know if we're going to do this. So, but we still need someone to kind of keep an eye on it and think about it.
And plan. That's what she would say, you know, is that we don't know what the water needs are going to be in the future. So we can't just give up right now and not study this. We need to keep an eye on this.
And what's at stake if they actually do end up doing it? And talk a little bit about your trip on the lake.
Yeah, so I got to go there. I got to take an airboat ride out on the Great Salt Lake with a guy called R. Jeffrey Hicks, and also a wetland ecologist came with us. It was a really interesting time to go. We went this spring, and after this winter, which was really wet, the water level in the Great Salt Lake was actually really high, higher than it's been in a number of years. And it was rainy the day that we were out there, so the whole day was just really wet. There was water everywhere. It's kind of a really beautiful place. There's lots of birds. You can take an airboat, doesn't actually need any water. You can like go over mud flats too once you get going. Mm-hmm. So we were going through all these marshy places and seeing all this different wildlife and cool spots. And you could see the Wasatch Front rising behind us. It's really beautiful. And R. Jeffrey, the guy that took us out, he grew up in that area, and he grew up waterfowl hunting on the Great Salt Lake, and that area is really important to him. He still spends a ton of time out there, and it's a really part of his culture and his community and his life. And so if the Bear River were diverted and there was less water going into the lake, especially right where we were, which was really near the mouth of the river, that bay would probably mostly dry up. So you couldn't, it would just completely change the lake. You know, those marshes wouldn't be there. The birds wouldn't be there. You wouldn't go out there, you know?
Yeah. I think what I think is interesting about this diversion question on the Bear River is that it sort of brings to the fore a lot of different stakes for different people. And so your sort of hardcore environmentalist ecologist doesn't really want to see that lake diminished because it has such value for the birds that pass through or live there. And that ties into a culture of the people that live there who are duck hunters. There's a huge amount of duck hunting that goes on around those marshes and the edge of the lake.
And
that's a real
hunting
challenge for them too.
Yeah, not just hunting too. I mean, other people go out just to enjoy the lake or just to go bird watching, just to be out there.
Well, then they'll just have to enjoy the beach, I guess.
Yeah.
The dusty beach.
And the damaging dust that they breathe in.
But it's a huge question also because there are a lot of people moving into the West, and that's, you know, I think a potential area for political conflict and something to watch.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the other side of that too is that, you know, different people told me, you know, I love living in Salt Lake City. I want my kids to be able to stay here when they grow up, and they can't stay here if there's not water. You know, so yeah, it's tough on both sides.
that wasn't the only two stories that we did in our issue. We also kind of tackled the question of the Glen Canyon Dam, because it is such a iconic dam and such a symbolic dam for the environmental movement. But I think the truth is, in both of your stories and in this one, it's really complicated. And there's this sort of idea out there that you could take down the Glen Canyon Dam, and you, the water that would rush out of that, or forevermore sort of rush down the river, would fill Lake Mead higher, and you'd have less evaporation, and you'd have just as much water for everyone. But what we kind of tackle in this issue is the fact that, that argument is not so simple. It's based on some older science, and it gets kind of tricky when you're talking about these dam removals, because they have become a fixture of these communities and sort of ecologies in a way, and political ecologies. So while some purists would want to see Glen Canyon Dam come down, it's not going to be the same canyon that Abbey wrote about, that people sort of fell in love with this writing. And you'd lose a lot of hydropower, and you may not actually gain as much water as you think, because there's probably less water soaking into the sandstone that could be saturated at the bottom of the Lake Powell. So it's just a very complicated question. Kate, any thoughts on sort of what you took away from all of this reporting and editing in terms of dams in the West? Should they all come down?
I would, you know, two sides of my personality are or in answering that question. And the truth is, it doesn't matter. They aren't all going to come down. And there's a lot that can be done before you take a dam down to restore more natural processes. One of the things that I thought was really interesting, so our correspondent Krista Langlois wrote that story, and she and I talked quite a bit about it. And one of the keystones of that story and the Elwha story is that we really don't understand the system that we've created that well. We do not understand the way rivers work before you put dams in that well, and we certainly don't understand what happens once you put a river in. Because you don't just, so I've been driving around the West my whole life. I just think of dams as part of the landscape. But what the Elwha story taught me is you're creating a whole new system with its own logic. Rivers with dams in them have a way of working that is particular to that river and that dam, but there are some commonalities that we just don't know that well. And so when you talk about taking dams down, I think it's really valuable to look closely at something like the Elwha and similar dam removals, and to say, what happened here that we can learn from, either for keeping this other dam in or for taking it out? And that's just so true for Glen Canyon, because the stakes are so high. The Elwha, part of the reason it could be a living laboratory is because the stakes, all things considered, were pretty low. I mean, they had to build a new water treatment plant. They had to do some preparation. It took out some campgrounds and some roads. But taking down Glen Canyon Dam would reshape the political architecture of the West. And to do that, you need to understand to some extent what you're doing before you do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one thing we're learning right now is that most of our lawmakers, politicians, and leaders are really, really cognizant of these really sophisticated things before they make decisions. I'm just kidding.
I know, but I think that we as citizens can step in there, and like Westerners and people are very curious. We like to understand what's going on around us. I think that's part of the appeal of Lake Powell. What a strange landscape that is, this giant body of water in the desert with these crazy cliffs around it. I think much of the research done on the Elwha was supported by citizens. That can be done by citizens anywhere in the West. We can take on that burden of curiosity, and I think we should.
Emily, last thoughts. Should all the dams come down and no dams ever be built again?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said it's really complicated, you know? I mean, there's just so many things to consider. Yeah. There's not one answer that's going to work in every place.
Yes. Well, if you want to find out more about these dams and what Emily finally answers, you can visit us online at hcn.org. If you want to continue this particular conversation, you can also do so at kvnf.org. I want to thank you once again, Kate Schimmel and Emily Benson, for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Brian. It's fun.
For West Obsess, I'm Brian Calvert. I'm the editor-in-chief of High Country News. And as always, thanks for listening.